Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Well, we got here finally for a panel that is going to be difficult to beat the last one, because I found it very interesting and also humorous, and humorous from the financiers, the big tick in the box, right? So we're going to talk about steering through troubled waters. My name is David Barrow. I'm from Bureau Veritas. I'm responsible for our business across Europe and North and South America. So I've just come back to Europe. I've spent the last 6 years with BV in Singapore. And people say to me, you must feel disruptive coming back to the UK. I said, no, I don't. And they say, how long have you been here for? I say, 4 weeks. They will speak to you in another 4 weeks and say, how you feel? So I'm expecting disruption in my life, because we live in challenging times in our industry right now. But it's always challenging times, right? It's always challenging times. This morning and this afternoon, a lot of the panelists took some of our topics away from us, because disruption was mentioned in most of the sessions this morning and this afternoon. But we have challenges. We have the decarbonisation challenge, which was talked about this morning. The road to GHG 2030 and 2050 reduction targets, they loom large. Let's not forget digital data and innovation. Both are necessary, and you cannot separate them to be safe, efficient, and to achieve carbonisation. And of course, we have the geopolitical aspects today. Innovation is moving at a faster pace than ever. Can we keep up as an industry? For those of you who are around for the dot-com boom, I was part of the Level Seas area. I remember we brought some in from Deutsche Bank, and after 2 weeks he said, boy, you guys move a dead slow ahead. You've got to move faster. And I think as an industry, we have moved faster from there, but can we keep up with the pace of technology? So I mentioned previous panelists today talked about decarbonisation and alternative fuels. And we definitely see a greater sense of urgency today. And this was clearly evident in COP28, for those of you who were there. I was at COP27, and I came away very disillusioned. COP28, I think the urgency was realised, and I think we all realise the task that we have ahead. So let's talk disruption. We've been in troubled waters before. It's funny, nobody talks about our industry if nothing's happening. When things happen, when things go wrong, we've got the Baltimore, the Dali, we've got all stuff going on now in the Red Sea, then things start to talk about our industry. We reacted to COVID. One of the positive things about COVID was it raised the profile of how important shipping was, and people realised that. I think another benefit from COVID, which was a huge disruptor, is the focus we then put onto our seafarers, our biggest asset, looking after our seafarers, and we need to make sure that we carry on doing that as well. So when we look at the geopolitical disruption at the moment, operationally it can be seen as good, for absolute sure. Increasing ton miles, restricting supply, boosts certain markets. But it's bad for safety. It's bad for our seafarers. The tanker, the Sioux Union, is still on fire today. Our seafarers are still at risk. Our core workers are still at risk. So what does this mean for us in the future? We've got other disruptors on the horizon. We talked about Trump this morning, the uncertainty, the tariffs that may come along from there. We've got the issues with Taiwan. We've got the issues in the South China Sea. They're looming. What impact will they have and disrupt us even further? So technology is certainly a disruptor as well. It continues at a huge pace. Will innovation, including AI, give us the efficiencies and the productivity that we need? It's a busy space out there. I'm sure lots of owners, operators, and other stakeholders have IT innovation suppliers knocking on their door every day. Is the space too busy? Is it going to offer us the right productivity that we actually need? We have to work in collaboration. It was a while before collaboration was mentioned today. I'm a big fan of it. After spending 6 years in Singapore and working with the MPA in Singapore, they've got collaboration completely right. They are masters at it. And we should learn how they pull the different stakeholders together and work together as well. So I'm sure we'll continue to find our way. It's going to be a challenge. And before we move on to the panel, I have to say it was mentioned a couple of times today about people. Our ability to attract people to this industry is not great. It's really not great to attract them and to retain them. We are in a great position right now, today, data, digital, innovation, decarbonisation, to attract young talent. And it's a different type of skill set we need to attract to our industry and keep those people when they come in. And it's a challenge to us all. I'm a master mariner. My father was a chief engineer. I never sailed as master, I sailed as mate. But when I left the sea, when I got my master's ticket, my father was appalled. He said, "You haven't reached your top of your career." And when I look back, then for seafarers, the top of their career was probably a master or chief engineer, right? But that's only halfway there. And we need to encourage those people to come ashore and fill the jobs that we all do in this room, for absolute sure. So let's support people, let's attract to them. It's everybody's responsibility to attract new talent to our industry. So let us turn to the panel today. We've got Mr. Mark O'Neill, the President and CEO of Columbia Group and the President of Intermanager. Nice to see you, Mark. Mr. Guy Platton, Secretary General of the International Chamber of Shipping. Great to see you, Guy. Long time, Singapore a couple of years ago, I think. So great to see you. We've got Mr. Bud Dorr, EVP for Maritime Policy and Government Affairs for the MSC Group. Bud, I always like to hear you talk, so I'm looking forward to some of your inputs today. And we've got Mr. Soteris Raftis, Secretary General, the European Community Shipowners Association. So gentlemen, welcome. I think our panel is probably the worst one, right? Because we're second to last, right? So we've got to keep people up and going and gone. So let's turn the question very, very general to, first of all, it's going to be the same question to all of you about disruption. How do you see it? Are you more worried about geopolitics, the energy transition, and the need for greater sustainability? So Mark, please, take the lead.
Thanks very much, and we'll try and keep you all awake. We see this as a challenge, being the second to last. No, disruption. Look, lest we all forget, shipping is an adventure, and it's always been an adventure. I remember when I was studying law all those years ago and read those early cases, they were all about the adventure that was shipping, and owners and charterers and insurers gather around the table and they decide on the risk and their risk appetite, and they embark on the adventure, which gives them, if it's successful, untold riches. So it was then, and so it is today. So we are adventurers, each and every one of us, and we have to remember that sometimes. So I see all of the challenges, and I see them just as that, as challenges, as something that we as an industry sector have to deal with. We're incredibly agile, incredibly dynamic, incredibly motivated and proactive for the most part, much more than any other sectors. I don't think there's another sector that came through COVID as well as shipping, and came through COVID actually enhanced in all those qualities as shipping did. I do, one concern of mine in the overall geopolitical challenges that we face is the emergence of not just two different power players, if you like, but three now, the white, the grey, and the dark fleet. And that does concern me. It concerns me as a lawyer, and it concerns me as an owner, wearing my owner's hat, and as a manager, where we have this not just dichotomy, but whatever the three power house is, whatever the word for that is, because the dark fleet seems to represent the rule breakers. They're the rule makers, the takers, and then the rule breakers. And that concerns me when I consider the safety of my ships, the safety of my crew out there, if God forbid, there is ever a collision, as we saw recently with a vessel in that dark fleet. So that does concern me. And it concerns me where that also implies that the rule of law, the UN conventions, the EU conventions, simply don't apply. And we're going from a situation where we have the rule breakers to actually, well, what which is better, which side is the right one. It's a bit the Star Wars, those Star Wars fanatics amongst you, it's the Empire and then it's the Alliance or the Rebel Alliance. That seems to be a situation we're getting to, which does concern me. Where will that go? Will the Rebel Alliance or the Empire ever come back? Will we ever be one again, where everyone abides by the rule of law and the rule of the law of the sea? I'm not so sure. So that concerns me a bit more than the geopolitical.
Yeah, some really good points there, Mark, for absolutely sure, and we'll touch on the Dark and Grey Fleet a bit later on, because I think it's a concern for all of us, right? For absolutely all of us, for absolutely sure. So, Terry's, to tell the audience, how do you see disruption? What's your biggest concern?
I don't think that we can separate geopolitics from the energy transition or the discussion about taking protectionist measures and open trade. They're all interconnected, interlinked. Of course, we're going through high uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty. We are facing the enormous challenge of the energy transition, and we need to turn it, the challenge, to an opportunity for us. The geopolitical uncertainty also makes our sector more visible. People are more aware of our contribution, for instance, in Europe, to energy security, to the supply chain security, to the food security of our continent. But of course, visibility comes with responsibility. And all this uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, makes also the cost of the energy transition much higher. In Europe yesterday, we've got the long-awaited Draghi report that identified the weaknesses of our economy and what we need to improve in terms of competitiveness. Professor Draghi found that the overall cost for the European economy will be 8 billion euros a year for the whole economy. For shipping alone, it's going to be 40 billion euros a year for European shipping. The cost is enormous. And we need to organize the energy transition, having at the same time to deal with all this geopolitical uncertainty. But I would say it's not a question of if, it's a question of how. This is happening anyway. The energy transition is happening anyway. The different sectors of the economy will decarbonize. And if we need to draw some lessons from other sectors, how they organized their energy transition, I think that we need to look at the car makers, especially the European car makers, and how they have been left behind because they didn't invest on time. So a good lesson for us is that we need to organize ourselves, and it's not a question of if, it's a question of how, and we need to be more present and more vocal when the decisions are taken.
Yeah, it's interesting, going back to other industries where they've fallen behind. I think for us as an industry, you know, we are making progress. The pace has increased, for absolute sure. But Guy, what about you? Are you seeing the pace increase for us, you know, attacking that disruption and making it work for us as a global industry?
I think what's the Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times. I think that can certainly be said for shipping at the moment. We really do live in interesting times. Geopolitics, we're seeing that fracturization of the world, that polarization of the world. We're seeing security situations, the Red Sea being a prime example, where the traffic through the Suez Canal has dropped to under 50% of what it was before the attack started. We're seeing protectionism. We're seeing nations starting to look inwardly rather than outwardly. And I think the whole concept of the international rules-based order is under threat like never, ever before. I've just come back from an ICS board meeting, and we discussed all these topics during the course of today, and we had a very good lecture from someone who is an expert on the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, and we're seeing that under threat like never before, with coastal states and port states trying to sort of regain control. So we've got a lot of headwinds to face as an industry. I mean, Mark talked about the shadow fleet and the, you know, it's a law of unintended consequences. If you're going to place all these sanctions in place, trade will have a way of getting through regardless. And the trouble is, it's not going to be as well regulated as it was before. Yeah. And that means less safe than it was before. And that's something I think we have to be cognizant of as we move forward. The energy transition, Satoshi, it's a massive opportunity for our industry. We've just completed a hydrogen report, which is available on our website, which looks at... we're going to need 500, at least 500 hydrogen or ammonia carriers in the next few years in order to be able to assist the world in decarbonisation. That's a huge opportunity for shipping to go and do that. And we're going to be the facilitator through our clean energy marine hubs, where we're working with governments to make sure we think strategically how we're going to place all these new infrastructure. So it's a challenge. It needs the backing of governments, but I do know that industry, compared to where it was 5 years ago, we are really up for this, and we know technology-wise we can transition. And I think sustainability, I think touched upon in your introduction about the cruise, about how we're going to attract the next generation of seafarers. Yeah. That's just so important. We estimate we're going to be some 70,000 to 80,000 seafarers short by 2026, and we are competing in an ever-competitive landscape for that talent. Our ships are becoming more sophisticated. And how do we persuade a young person that it's okay to go away for 7-8 months of the year when they could be at home doing other things? So we've really got to up our game and to make sure in sustainability, it's also sustainability of our industry and the training and the investment in our crews as well. So I think this disruption is around us at the moment, and it's not one thing. It's so many multiple things that we need to tackle as an industry going forward.
No, thanks, Guy. Some good points, and you know, about the collaboration, working together, and learning. So, Bud, MSC, big owner, you've got a hugely complex job there. Tell us your aspect and the MSC aspect about disruption. How are you addressing MSC?
Yeah, so normally I like to go last because I can pick up on the things that weren't said, but topics were covered pretty well here. So, let me just start by saying, you know, we are a business full of problem solvers. I mean, that is really our core work. And if you don't enjoy a challenge and you don't enjoy solving problems, I got bad news. You probably picked the wrong line of work. I don't think there's ever a time when it's really easy street. But what I will say right now is that the pace at which items of disruption are coming at us is probably close to unprecedented, because they're coming in so many different ways. But all of these are solvable challenges from an operational standpoint. The things that actually concern me more in the bigger picture, some of the fellow speakers and yourself mentioned it as well, is that what do things like a non-state actor completely taking control of one of the world's most vital sea lanes from the developed countries that have very capable navies, what does that mean for the world order? What does it mean when developed countries are paying very little regard to the world order with regard to national manning standards, for example, labor standards, when we have an unprecedented global labor standard that we all work so hard together with the unions to put together and the International Labor Organization? What does it mean when geopolitical differences of opinion have gotten down to the micro level where, you know, we have trouble being kind to each other on social media if we disagree, or people walk up and get away from a dinner table? Yeah, you always had arguments, but it seems like it's more polarized than it was before, and we're less tolerant of different views. So I get more concerned about those bigger picture things that really disrupt the longer term. Mm. But for today, when it comes to decarbonization, we have to do it. I mean, we have to. The rest of society is going to decarbonize. I think 5 years ago, we were laggards. We were really not up to the task. Where we are today, I'm incredibly proud of. We're to the point today where I'm confident that the ship owners have a vision for what equipment they will need. They have a vision for where they will get the financing. What they need is the fuel. And at the end of the day, we've gotten ourselves to the point where we're now ahead of the energy providers. And if we had the fuels available at scale in the market, I think you would see we would be dramatically leading most of the other sectors in society and society overall. And I think we need to look at the positive of that. That is a really good example of collaborative problem solving, getting past our disagreements that we may have about legal structures, policy matters, or operations, and actually addressing a major issue society is facing. And we will be not only examples for the rest of society in the end, but as Guy said, we will be facilitators for the rest of society, because they're going to need us to move the molecules around.
No, thanks, Bud. Absolutely. Interesting about the availability of fuels. If you were in Hamburg last week at SMM, the Tradewinds conference, I felt sorry for the poor Maersk guy. He was there, he was on stage, and he was asked the question, so is methanol still your first choice for Maersk, right? And he said, fundamentally, yes. And he said, but where are you going to get the green methanol from, right? And he said, we don't know. He said, will you use brown methanol? And the Maersk guy said, well, we'll use it to train our crews, to get everything ready, but we still need that source of the alternative fuels, the green fuels. And it's a huge problem, right? Huge problem. I spent a lot of time down in Australia in the 6 years I was in Singapore working with some of the big people down there. It still hasn't really got off the ground. For green ammonia, green hydrogen, it's still being talked about. Huge amounts of money being invested. That's a big question that no one can ask is, where are we going to get the fuels from the future? We talk about fuels, but when we talk about innovation, data, digital, we're moving at a fast pace. We really are. So, Mark, do you feel as though we're embracing it as an industry? Are you embracing it as one of the biggest ship managers?
Sorry, embracing what?
Data and digital.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us as companies are generating huge amounts of data. We're embracing that data in very tight embraces, but are we actually harvesting that data? Are we sharing that data? And I think that's the problem. Our industry is incredibly competitive and capitalistic and successful, and so we're very jealous of everything that each of us do and protective of how we do it and not sharing how we do it with others, and that includes data. So I think until such time as we allow that data to be shared and harvested properly and analysed, then we won't be obtaining maximum value out of it. I think there is huge opportunity. I think we're still scratching the optimization surface until we do that. When you look at what the aircraft industry does or any other sector in the overall logistics, until you actually are able to harvest that data and process that data and truly optimize, we're really just, as I said, scratching the surface. And that's the challenge that the Columbia Group looked at when it got into bed, proverbially, with CETA manages all of the IT for the airlines and is actually owned by the airlines, and CETA wanted to really bring that level of optimization into the maritime space and create this maritime backbone, and that's what we're trying to do, so that vessels can talk to ports, can talk to terminals, can talk to aviation, can talk to haulage, can talk to trains, and when you achieve that, you really will change things and you really will be processing data. In the same way, and apologies again to Bud, because I remember 3 years ago or 4 years ago, we were sitting in a conference in Saudi, and I said, yeah, but Bud, your MSC is not really a ship owner, it's more of a logistics, and you took offense at that wrongly and then bought 400 ships to prove me wrong in the last 3 years. But no, of course they're a massive, the biggest ship owner, but they're also part of a huge logistics framework, and that's where the rest of shipping needs to get to through IT and through the different platforms, so that we can operate on the same sort of level that these big liner companies, if I dare say, logistics ship-owning liner companies on the same level. But that's the challenge, for sure.
Yeah, it's a great point, Mark, about sharing data. You're right. Far too many owners will say, it's my data, that's my competitive advantage, right? Or it may be the equipment manufacturer saying, who owns the data? Is it the owner? Is it the engine manufacturer? Are they going to share that data? Like you said, Mark, you know, unlike the air industry, well, they'll share that data. You know, Chris from ABS this morning, a great point about we need to move away from time-based maintenance and use data, use monitoring. So if there's an equipment failure, then the classification society can go to owners of the same components and say, hey, you better order a new piece because that's going to fail in 2 months. That'd be the sweet spot. Bud, what do you think then from the MSC aspect?
Well, I get really uncomfortable with the word digitalization. It's kind of like throwing out the word pet rock, make up whatever you want it to be. I like to think of it more in terms of how do you use available technology to make what you do more efficient and improve the quality of the work that you get from your workforce by, and also relieving the burden on them. And so there's all sorts of tools to do that. But it needs to have a purpose, in my opinion. It doesn't do a lot of good to put a new electronic gadget into play, whether it's a system, you know, in your IT network, or whether it's a particular piece of equipment on a ship, if it doesn't have a real purpose and it's not helping you. There are lots of these things that can really help us. I mean, I think we can really take a lot of the administrative burden off the shipboard staff. Seafarers need that. They also need confidence that they get a higher level of performance with less effort put in to how they actually operate the ship day to day, but we've also got to match that up with training. And then on the more administrative side, I'll give you an example, electronic bill of lading. I've had this email exchange with someone that I met when he was a student at World Maritime University, desperate because he shipped a single container. They lost the bill of lading. And, you know, they literally lost a piece of paper. Well, you know, you can't give a box up without seeing who owns it. Somebody needs a bill of lading. And I thought, gosh, if there's ever a more simple argument for electronic bill of lading, here it is. Nobody's got to wait around for it. If you lose it, you get another one. It's stored electronically, and you can account for it much better. There are things we can really do. Operationally, you know, we just made a big announcement yesterday. You know, we've adapted our network to have a standalone service, east-west, you know, five different trade lanes and 34 different loops. But it's really going to be optimized through matching that up with the technology we have available that really helps improve the efficiency of not only what we're doing on the water, but how we're interfacing with our customers and how our customers can actually better track their entire supply chain. A lot of those tools exist today. What the Digital Container Shipping Association has done has been outstanding work. What the U.S. Department of Transportation has done with their flow project has been outstanding work. We just need to sort out what are the things that really are solving a problem and use them.
Yeah, sure. I mentioned before, Bud, that we need to attract a different skill set, right? How easy do you find it to attract that different skill set for bringing those new processes and products and services into MSC, particularly from the shore side?
Yeah, on the shore side element, you've kind of got the whole world to choose from. We do okay. But if you look at the nature of the workforce today, they don't think much of switching jobs every couple of years. So no. Retaining them may be harder than recruiting them. And it's really, you know, a big loss for a company if you take a chance on someone, you train them, you invest in them, you believe in them, and lo and behold, they find something they like better and they move on after a very short period of time. So I think one of the keys, and a couple of you have already alluded to it, we need to do our job, all of us, at convincing young people what a wonderful industry this is to be a part of and how important it is to society. They shouldn't, as you pointed out, they shouldn't just recognize we're important when there's a disaster or something that is, you know, makes nice imagery on television or, God forbid, people get killed. They should think of us as, hey, thanks for moving 90% of the world's trade. And we need to do a much better job of explaining how valuable this role is, and for us, how important the people are to making it happen, whether it's the seafarers or the people ashore. We all need to step up our game, myself included, to energize youngsters to really look at this as a great profession, which I think all of us in this room believe it is.
Can I just add, I mean, this isn't rocket science, is it? How does a company attract more people into it? And I remember in the days when I was in the Army 30 years ago and we had a person shortage, there was great adverts on television saying what a varied life the Army was and sports, and there were people in playing tennis and skiing and going to wild far-flung places, and all of a sudden the numbers rose because the messaging was getting out and the PR was getting out. As a sector, we are massively inward-looking. All of our problems, even if you take the alternative fuel debate, it's always focusing inwards and what's good for shipping and what can shipping look outward. Look at the car industry. Yeah, you mentioned this early on. Look at other sectors. We have to get out there and we have to get the message out that shipping is this wonderful, as Bud said, this wonderful opportunity for everyone, whether it's IT, whether it's law, whether it's finance, whether it's asset owning, whether it's IT. There's so many different opportunities. So I think we need to do better on the PR.
No, absolutely, absolutely. We talk about innovation, data, digital. So that opens the door for cyber attacks, right? I have to say, when I first saw the first clip of the Dolly in Baltimore, my first reaction was cyber attack, right? That was my first reaction. Just before I left Singapore, there was an incident, I don't know if people saw it, there was a huge dredger that lost power, just missed one container ship, went smack bang into midships of a bunker tanker, which was bunkering a container ship. You know, and there was 400 tons spilled, but the devastation just on 400 tons there. First thing to me said, cyber attack. It wasn't. So Guy, what are your thoughts as an industry? Are we taking cyber attacks responsible? Are we aware of what the dangers are? Are we taking enough action to protect ourselves?
I think ship owners are having to take action against cyber attacks. We've seen some recently, the last few weeks, in the Suez Canal with GPS being disrupted. We're seeing GPS disrupted elsewhere. So we know these things are happening, whether they're malign or whatever the actors are doing them. We know the cyber security on board ship is very important. We issue guidelines, we issue support, and we know this is something that the International Maritime Organization is taking increasingly an interest in, because there's great benefits of digitalization, as been highlighted. There's also great risks that go with it in terms of bad actors either stealing the data or disrupting the data, yeah, or changing, yeah, the data so that accidents happen on board the ship. Yeah. So, and it's one of those things. You can never reach a place where you're safe, because I think the really sophisticated criminals and sometimes backed by states as well, they will try and find ways around all these things. So it's funny, we've just launched our barometer survey, which is what keeps the top CEOs awake at night. And funny enough, cybersecurity is right at the top of that list.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So it just shows you how worried the industry is about that. They see the opportunities, but they also see the risks. You know, ships are no longer standalone units now. They're connected all over the world. So that's something that we are certainly discussing as an international chamber. And we discuss with ship owners as well. And what guidelines and what advice and what support and help can we put in place to try and allow ship owners and managers and operators to combat these?
Yeah. And, you know, it's not just risks from malicious actors. I mean, as we become more and more reliant on technology, risk of just failure of components, and particularly if you've lost the hard skills it took to do the things in before you had the electronics, you know, there are real risks there just from plain failures.
Just on that, it was just a funny anecdote. I remember when GPS first came out, and I was on the bridge of a ship, and we started to rely on this. Then the GPS failed, and I was thinking, how do I take a star sight, a sun sight? Because that's all I had at that time. So you're right, we lose those core skills about how to actually get over these things when things do go wrong.
One of the objectives of this company, SmartSea, the collaboration between us and CETA, is just on this to enhance cybersecurity. But the fact is that because our industry is so fragmented, and because there's so many legacy systems around because of the various mergers and consolidations, they're not just cracks for hackers to get in. These are wide open doors, the wide open gates. It's very, very easy. Again, you don't have to be rocket scientists to hack some of these shipping companies, or indeed the ships. It's very easy. It probably hasn't happened more, because it's not that exciting to do. But if it was, they would certainly do that. Again, compare that with the airline industry, where you see occasionally the headline, the airport goes down list, but it's very, very, very rare, because they've got that compatibility and they've whittled down their legacy systems and they have a common IT backbone. So I think shipping is, I agree with everybody else, what everyone is saying, hugely exposed because of the legacy systems and because of the incompatibilities and the wide open doors.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, so Therese, do you think there's any other disruptors that could disrupt us hugely? When I say disruptors, someone very different could come and disrupt our industry. Example, Amazon, right? The Bureau Veritas, we've been doing a lot of work on remote surveys, use of drones. You know, and I've always said, in years to come, someone like Amazon could be a disruptor, because they can employ those techniques, they could employ technical people to monitor it. Do you see any other potential big disruptors that can come in and disrupt us?
I remember I was invited to one of our ICS meetings 2 years ago, and we were discussing who will be the Elon Musk of the shipping sector. And of course, there is this discussion who will disrupt best the industry. But the thing is that our industry needs also a level playing field. when it comes to all these disruptive forces, when it comes to geopolitics, when it comes to the energy transition, when it comes to digitalization. We need to make sure, let me take an example, the energy transition. We need to make sure that how we're going to make it happen for all of us. And as you said, it's a very fragmented industry when it comes to the online systems. One of the reasons why ships are lining up outside ports is that we haven't managed yet to optimize port operations. This is where we also need a level playing field. We shouldn't leave it to the initiative, to different port communities. We need to better engage the port communities, for instance. And this is a huge opportunity for us. In times of geopolitical uncertainty, in times of rising protectionism, in times where people doubt about the contribution of our industry, we need to better engage at local level as well. We talk a lot about the energy transition. Who is going to pay for the energy transition? Who is going to make these fuels available? For us, from a European perspective, this is also a huge opportunity for the European fuel industry to invest more in industrial capacity. It's a huge opportunity for the maritime cluster to thrive in Europe, and we need to create these synergies. We have been under the emissions trading scheme in Europe, which will generate billions of euros every year. We're going to pay around 9 billion, if I'm not mistaken, 9 billion euros a year. We managed to earmark 2 billion out of the pot of 9. This is clearly not enough, and this is not for the ship owners. This is for building industrial capacity. We organized the energy transition in other sectors of the economy, the car makers, the power sector, and the policymakers are telling us, but yeah, they've done it. Nowadays, we produce more than 60-70% of our energy in Europe from renewables. But the question is how and where the technology comes from. So I think it's the energy transition. The fact that we're dealing with high uncertainty is also a huge opportunity for us to better engage with other stakeholders at national, local, international level. And this is where we see a huge opportunity. In Brussels, for instance, we said, why not pushing for producing 40% of the fuels we need when we call at European ports in Europe? And this brings us closer to the fuel suppliers in Europe, to the oil majors as well, but to the European fuel suppliers as well.
What I always say, where there's threats, there's opportunities, right? Absolutely, absolutely. We've got 2 minutes left, so I'm going to throw open an open question, right, about a potential disruptor. It's not being mentioned today. I'm seeing the word being mentioned more and more and more. There's lots of question marks about it. Will nuclear play a part as a fuel in the future for our industry? I'll open that up.
Maybe you've got 1 minute. Maybe 30. The only person on the panel that's actually been a naval nuclear engineer. Maybe I'll go first. I think the short answer is yes, it has a role to play. It will definitely have a potential serious role to play to augment the renewable energy that's coming from wind and solar to actually produce the green hydrogen that we need as a feedstock for the other fuels. So if people are willing to look at the new designs as opposed to pressurized water reactors, which I was never favorable on, I think they're much safer. They have a lot of potential. From a technical perspective, I think there's no reason why this couldn't be applied on ships, but the regulatory and policy landscape
That's
may not.
That's the big one, right? Quickly, Guy.
Absolutely, and I think Bud touched on it as well. We've got to also, there's a education of the wider society on the fourth generation nuclear reactors now, which are significantly safer than the first generation. And I do believe will be part of our energy mix going forward. It'll have to be.
Okay, great. Stereos.
I mean, as an organization, we don't have particular views about different technologies, but we need to take also into account, at least in Europe, the reactions we're going to face from
whole different stakeholders. Mark?
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that's been said. They've got to win the PR battle first, and I think if one looks at how quickly oil and gas was villainized, then I think the rehabilitation of nuclear is equally possible in the next 5 to 10 years. I think technology-wise, it's certain aspects of it safe and will become safer. So PR, battle to win, and then no reason why not.
No, absolutely. Great comments, guys. Thank you. Well, that's our 40 minutes up. We hope we kept you engaged. Nuclear, very interesting, right? And I think, but the last thing I want to say, which I was really encouraged, where you said, the last 5 years as an industry, we've really made progress. And we need to keep that up. And my final word is, attracting young talent to the industry. It's all of our responsibility. Let's take that responsibility on and attract young people in. Thank you.